This is the second cassette in the Joe Herzenberg interview on July 27, 1995. So this is cassette number 7.27.95-JH.2.
In my view, a resolution would not have passed. Even though I was closeted, I had talked with at least a couple of my colleagues about gay rights, I remember a long conversation I had with Bev Qualick, who was my closest friend on the council, and she argued then, she's come a long way by now, by the way, sexual orientation was not a legitimate basis for political activity. That was very disappointing when she said that, but she clearly believed it. So, and the mayor was at least on sex and family issues, was a fairly conservative Lebanese Catholic. I didn't think he would be big on this. So what I urged Lightning to do was, instead of asking the council for a resolution, which would not pass, to ask individual members to sign, this is going to sound awfully innocuous, you know, a public statement against murder, or there was gay-related murder, which is what we did. And I want to go back and explain something, that most of what I have been doing in my political life was not very well thought out in advance. And in fact, as far as I'm concerned, it's a major criticism of gay politics nationally, locally, statewide, nationally. I think that far too much has been spent on reactions to individual incidents or situations, whatever. I think, you know, the model of the Inc Fund lawyers, for example, is something that only now are lots of gay lawyers really figuring out, partly because times are getting worse in some ways. I don't want to indict everybody, but I just think, generally speaking, there has been too much ad hoc and not enough long-range planning. But that doesn't mean I didn't do some long-range planning. And I actually had an individual model in mind, someone you might even know of, Alan Speer. No, you don't know Alan Speer. Alan Speer was someone I vaguely knew in New Haven as a graduate student. He got a PhD in American history at Yale, did a dissertation on the blacks in Chicago, which is still sort of classic work, teaches at the University of Minnesota, and is right now is the president pro tem of the Minnesota Senate. He was elected to the state senate from his district in Minneapolis when he was still in the closet. And he did very well in his first couple of terms, and then he came out, you know, and then was reelected. And that seemed to me to be, and that's, of course, it's not just Alan Speer who's done that, a fair number of people, not so much now as 15 years ago or longer. That was a very common political career model for gay politicians. And that was sort of mine, but see, it didn't work out right because, first of all, when I ran, I wasn't elected. I was only appointed to a 2-year term, so I didn't have that 4-year term to develop the splendid record that I was intending to do. I only had 2 years, and then I had to take a stand on what I regard as a moral issue, housing for poor black people, which really made some people very mad, including friends of mine who lived in the neighborhood. And then I was defeated when I ran for re-election. So the whole plan, you know, backfired or didn't work at all. So I basically had to try another plan. And it was then that these importunings from Lightning Brown became, because he really did it. He had thought a lot of these things out. And his notion of how you did gay politics was start at the precinct meeting and get people to go to precinct meetings where they would come out to their neighbors and who probably already knew they were gay, so it wasn't going to be a big deal. And then you'd work your way up. You'd pass a modest gay rights resolution at the precinct level, and then you'd take that to the county convention. You'd go district convention, state convention. And he really provided that entire theoretical framework for how to do that. And he spent a great deal of his free time in 83 and 84 doing that, sending out letters to every gay people person we knew anywhere in North Carolina, urging them to go to precinct meetings, telling them exactly what to say. Some people actually did it. Not very many, but not very few outside of the Triangle, and a couple of people in Greensboro and Charlotte and someone in Greenville. I think it was really a very sound strategy. It's just that either he or we weren't charismatic enough to convince enough people to do it. I remember, this guy's name is not something that comes to my mind right now. He considers himself a rabbi. He is a devotee of leather and metal. And he looks, he's now probably about 40, 45, but his body is covered with leather and metal, like some of these young kids. He went to his precinct meeting. He lived in a black precinct in Durham. He was the only non-black person. He was the only Jew at this, and he certainly was the only person who would even say gay or homosexual. He left and by this time, Lightning and I were sharing a house, the house I live in on Cobb Terrace. He left this 40-minute message on our answering machine about how what a wonderful experience the precinct meeting had been. You know, he went and explained to all these black women who were there that he wanted them to vote for a gay rights resolution, and what was that, they asked, and he explained. And it was something like, not exactly like, but something like, your civil rights, but it's for us. We helped you, won't you help us? Passed unanimously. He didn't know black people, even though they lived on both sides of the street. He never talked to them except to say hello. Now he asked them to support something he regarded as fairly intimate and personal and even secretive, and they all said yes. Now, it would have been nice if we had someone like him in every county of the 100 in North Carolina. It was more like a couple of dozen people. We did, and it's remarkable what such a small number of people did in 83, 84. The Orange County Democratic Party had been adopting gay rights resolutions since the middle 70s. Some of those same CGA people had been going to precinct meetings. We were beginning by the mid-80s to run out of things we could ask the Orange County Democrats to do. I remember once we changed the term sexual preference, since we thought that meant choice, and that was free will, to orientation. It was the politically correct thing to do. And I remember a woman in the county courthouse who was sitting in the pew behind me leaned forward and said, Joe, sometimes you have to explain to us why we're doing this. I mean, it sort of became, I believe, kind of moral touchstone in the Orange County Party that, you know, that gay rights was a good thing, and you might not like it as much or understand it as much as you liked to, or as you understood other issues, but it was the right thing to do. And the beginning years, in the mid-70s, there would always be a handful of vocal opponents, but they kind of faded away. And people were even afraid to ask questions, because I think they were afraid if they asked a question, they'd be regarded as anti-gay somehow, which is, we may well have regarded them as such. So that was the strategy, and we had organized a organization called Lesbian and Gay Democrats of North Carolina. There was a national, yes, and a few other people.
In that 83,
yes, there were. You inevitably have to leave lots of things out. There were a series of regional gay and lesbian conferences in the late 70s and early 80s. And in 83, the first one was here, of course.
Organized by?
Students. And they were mainly student-oriented to start with, and then they began to bring in perennial students like me, and then even people who had real jobs and normal people who happened to be gay and lesbian were brought into these conferences. But in 83, the conference came back here to Chapel Hill, and on an early one morning, the weekend of the conference, we had a meeting at my house, and we had about 15 or 20 people, including a closeted member of the legislature who served until last year, And a bunch of people from mainly the Triangle, but somebody from Greensboro, somebody from Greenville. And we organized this organization, only a couple of women, they were mainly men. And our notion was that we would be a gay caucus within the state party. And we would, I think we thought of two things, getting resolutions passed at local levels and taking them up to the state convention, and also trying to get work toward electing somebody gay to the national convention. There was a guy in Washington named Tom Chorlton, C-H-O-R-L-T-O-N, who for years was a one-person gay Democratic activist. And he organized something which was eventually called Gay Democrats of America or something. It was always pretty much a paper organization. It did very little except two things: work for more gay delegates to the national convention and try to get state organizations going. And he, this was a almost selfless person who would take a bus to Jackson, Mississippi to speak to three people. He eventually got burned out and retired to the Ozarks in Missouri. But for years, and he encouraged us to do this, there actually was a little tiny gay Democratic club in Raleigh called the Alice Toklas Democratic Club. That didn't do very much at labor. Didn't get much done, rather. They lobbied with the Raleigh City Council, but didn't get very far, didn't get very far with the Wake County Democratic Party. So we were hoping that we'd set up this state network, and Lightning and I would, you know, we'd drive over to Charlotte and come back in the middle of the night, and speak to five people and try to stir up things, and we did a little of that. But then, of course, there was this reaction when Bob Windsor found out about what we were doing, because in the meantime, John Bennett, who was Hunt's fundraiser, and whom I had barely known because when he was a student here, and we had mutual friends, he asked Lightning and I if we would help him raise money from Gay People for Hunt. And frankly, I have no idea what Hunt knew about this. My impression is that he didn't know much. Maybe he didn't want to know much. But we agreed. We didn't have very good contacts, but we had some. And we mainly raised money for two huge Hunt fundraisers, one in New York and one in Washington. We did a little work with fundraisers elsewhere, including when I was out in San Francisco for the convention. But that was basically what we did. And frankly, we did a lot of work, and it was somewhat productive. But considering that we were starting from scratch, and we didn't have an easy time convincing people, because believe it or not, Helms didn't have much of an anti-gay record back in '84. He had a little anti-gay record. The big anti-gay person in Congress was a Georgia congressman named Larry McDonald, who, fortunately or not, was killed in a plane crash, the Korean airline. Helms was on the next plane, and McDonald, I don't know where they were going or what they were going to Korea for, but Larry McDonald, who had his amendment to the legal services authorizing legislation, McDonald Amendment, which said that legal services lawyers could not basically do class action suits for gay people, was kind of the first anti-gay, at least in modern times, legislation in Congress. But Helms had only made a few sporadic comments, so we in fact wished he'd made more because it would have helped with the fundraising. So we had a little explaining to do. I mean, everybody knew that Helms was, politically speaking, way over on the right, but his connection with anti-gay stuff was restricted. But we still raised, I have no idea how much money. There was this huge fundraiser at the Trump Tower, and we got, and for us in those days, which was a fair amount of money, $50 a person, maybe 100 gay people to go to it, and about a similar number to a fundraiser later in the season in Washington. And the odd thing was, this guy Bob Windsor, who I don't know really what has come of him. There's supposed to be a very good oral history interview with him in the Southern. Correct myself. I don't think he ever okayed it. So it was too good, I think. The woman who did it told me that when I met her knocking on doors when I was running for office.
So it's on deposit but inaccessible.
Or maybe it's not even on deposit. Maybe he never even got that far.
For the tape, can you give a quick sketch of who this
was? Yes, well, he was a local realtor. He actually had his base in Chatham County, just south of the county line. But he had a lot, over the years, he'd done a lot of real estate development and rental work in Chapel Hill. There's a street, Windsor Circle, on the north side of town named for him, and he'd been around for a long time. And in 83, early in 83, he started this kind of crackpot right-wing, but not always right-wing, populist newspaper called The Landmark, which was a bi-weekly freebie that he just distributed freely in the Triangle and sent to every member of the Congress of the United States. There were two things that came out fairly clearly, as far as I was concerned, early on, that he really hated Jim Hunt with a passion, and exactly why it wasn't clear. And he didn't like gay people either. And so it was always some kind of concern on the part of Lightning and me that these two things might link up. And our agreement with John Bennett was that we would we could do whatever we wanted with the gay press, but not with the non-gay press. And there had been things in the New York gay newspapers, for example, about all this and the Trump Tower stuff. And I think that they probably even engaged in a little espionage. There was one phone conversation from somebody who alleged to be a New York gay newspaper reporter, who I think was more linked. And Lightning mainly talked to him, I think told him more than he should have, but that's okay in the long run. And then Windsor began attacking this Hunt gay connection. And for a few moments or hours, it was really terrifying. I remember driving over to Raleigh, to Hunt headquarters, to show them this so they would see it before it was in the regular media. They actually had seen it already by the time I got there. But I remember Betty McCain, who was the nominal campaign co-chair, giving me a hug and saying, "Oh, don't worry, Joe. And picking up on Helms' campaign slogan when he beat Galifianakis, they're not family. They're not us. Or Windsor isn't one of us," or something like that. And frankly, I personally, and I think Lightning might even say this, he's a little more radical and more bitter, maybe even a little more than a little, than I am. But I don't remember any personal recriminations. Now, they never exactly went another way to thank us for what we had done, except for John Bennett, which, you know, was at times fairly unpleasant. Every other week, these attacks, and some of them were pretty outrageous. I remember sending him to one of my brothers, just so that if this ever got blown up beyond locally or North Carolina, he'd know what was going on. And he was really worried that, you know, that I was suffering from all that. Wasn't really literally the case. We were, for a short time, obsessed with Bob Windsor and The Landmark. There was a room in the house on Cobb Terrace that just had stacks of all his newspapers, because it was cheaper to take a stack than Xeroxing them. Well, there was an incident, in fact, where Betty McCain's daughter, who was a lawyer in state government, was caught stealing or throwing, you know, because he just throw these things in state office buildings and in 7-Eleven type stores. But one of the more extreme things was he accused Lightning and me of, and the funny thing was, I had a friend who was working for Windsor, Ted Johnson, who was kind of a local communist student, not the real Communist Party, but these fractional communist parties that were floating around in the early 80s. This guy is a grandson of Guy and Gian Johnson, the distinguished sociologist and historian here. And he was flirting with one of these communist parties at the same time that he was setting type for Windsor. And why did I bring Ted up? He, about Windsor's work habits. Windsor would work late in the night, and I think was so tired or on caffeine that he would begin to imagine things that were just not related to reality. I mean, Lightning and I were raising money for Hunt in New York. That was true. But we were not setting up a chapter of the North American Man-Boy Love Association in cahoots with John D'Amelio and his partner in Greensboro. I think the connection there was that before he got his job in Greensboro, D'Amelio had worked for a Episcopal Daycare Coalition as some kind of manager in when he was finishing his dissertation. Daycare center, children, pedophilia, I think that's what it was all about. That makes sense to me if you're kind of making leaps. But, you know, if you were... And I don't think anybody in Chapel Hill really thought that Lightning and I were doing this. People who would think you're doing that were people who would be wanting to think these things, you know, anyway. My brother asked me at one point, he checked into the New Jersey law about libel and slander, and he was a paralegal with legal services, and he said that in New Jersey anyway, if you could prove that people were shunning you as a result, that you could bring a that was cause for action. Well, I don't know if it was in North Carolina or not. I really wasn't interested in suing anybody. But the fact was that nobody was shunning me, as far as I could tell. In fact, there was a woman in my neighborhood who had been mad at me ever since I had found her body when she tried to kill herself, who hadn't spoken to me for years. But all of a sudden, she's speaking to me. I mean, it's not people crossing the street not to speak to you. It was people crossing the street to say, you know, I'm sorry about all those things that Windsor's running. I mean, people were very supportive. And, of course, I'm mainly talking about Chapel Hill and Orange County. But as I told you, Betty McCain gave me a big hug. That was the initial reaction. And I was really a little scared because that was, although it wasn't our fault, this was appearing in the newspaper. That wasn't part of the agreement. He ranted for the greater part of 84 about that. And it's been so long, I've since recycled all those landmarks and only saved the juiciest ones. I mean, I remember one of our big battlegrounds over the years was the 4th District Convention. And in fact, Windsor, that is, according to Windsor, in one of his, I think it was his first anniversary landmark, he said why he started a paper was that at the 4th District Convention, this would have been in 82, I guess, that the 4th District Democrats had passed a gay rights resolution, and the News and Observer hadn't made a fuss about it. And he thought there should be a fuss made, and so he started his newspaper to make a fuss. And that was a great convention. And he was a delegate from Chatham County at that convention, and he ranted pretty much himself. But even we had time to talk to all the delegates because they call for a roll call vote. And so while people were waiting in line to cast their votes, there were three gay people there, Lightning and me and Gloria Faley, a local lesbian. It's kind of been the most active political lesbian in Chapel Hill. Hoping she'd run for the school board this year, but she's put it off for 2 years. We talked to every delegate who was coming down and explained what we thought this resolution meant, and most of them voted for it. So, he did make a big fuss, and then, of course, it was in September, I believe, Lightning and I were in Washington. We were actually phone banking to sell tickets to this Hunt fundraiser. And that night there was a debate on TV between Hunt and Helms. And it was about 9 o'clock. We were finishing up our telephoning. And I said to somebody, you know, back home in Chapel Hill, there's going to be a group at Democratic Party headquarters who are watching the debate on TV. I'm going to give them a call and see how it went. And I called them, and I remember who answered the phone, a guy named Harry Kaplan, who later went on Lieutenant Governor Jordan's staff and was the head of the state's bicentennial observance of the Constitution, I think. I don't know, it's a lawyer in Raleigh. And I said, Harry, this is Joe Herzenberg, and that's as far as I got. He started laughing. And then I could hear him saying, it's Joe, he's on the phone. And everybody was laughing. There were probably 30, 40 people there. And I said, Harry, what's the joke? And he said, well, you know, this bizarre thing happened. In the middle of the debate, Helms attacked Hunt for having people like you and Lightning and Virginia Puzo, at the time was the executive director of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, for supporting him. And he said he didn't explain who you were. And who is this Virginia Puzo, by the way? Is she a voter in Orange County? She was a voter in Brooklyn. So the odd thing was that there was very little explanation. I think one paper, I think the Charlotte Observer, bothered to explain who the three of us were. The News and Observer, you have to understand that Claude Sitton was, I believe, moderately, if not more than moderately, homophobic. An irony once was that Windsor ran a bank of pictures of Lightning and Claude Sitton and me. This was about why the News and Observer wouldn't report on this stuff. But I think from other evidence that Sitton didn't like talking about sex or intimate matters and homosexuality even less. So, excellent. And I once did not have the courage. He was at a Democratic convention, going up to him and saying, you know, I don't think you're much of a supporter of gay rights, but you were a damn good reporter and editor. But I didn't do that. So there was not much explanation of what this was all about. And so it was always hard for me to figure out what the impact on the campaign was. I would state very strongly that nobody ever said to me or said to anybody that I knew of, somebody in the Democratic Party, it was because of gay rights that we lost this. And considering the margin was narrow, you can always say almost anything was the cause. One of the people who wrote about it, I think it was this Harvard Business School study. Are you familiar with that? Some group of students at Harvard Business School did a study of the Helms-Hunt campaign, which was never published. I mean, I was shown this copy, which had all these rubber stamps on it, saying, don't show to anybody, don't repeat anything that's in this. It was just a classroom exercise. And they thought it had, the gay stuff had to do with Helms trying to show Hunt was weak, that he was maybe even effeminate, he wasn't man enough to be in that they didn't have to tar him heavily with having gay supporters, but just a little touch of it would be enough. He repeated the same thing in one of the later debates. He mentioned not me, but just Lightning and Ginny and Puzo. It's really sorry he left me out. but it was kind of bizarre. I mean, it seemed to me, why didn't he go a little further? He's a real puzzle to me. I've always thought that that his anti-gay rhetoric and behavior is not sincere. Now, a lot of people, of course, think that's a ridiculous thing to say, but I think he does it for fundraising and for rallying the troops. In this morning's NNO, he actually says he doesn't know any homosexuals. When he's fired homosexuals from his staff, He surely knew people like Terry Dolan. You know Terry Dolan? Terry Dolan was the founder of NITPAC, the National Conservative Political Action Committee, and who was pretty openly and even flamboyantly gay before he died of AIDS. And there is this bizarre phenomenon which nobody seems to write about. Maybe it's so fantastic it's beyond comprehension, of the right-wing gay people. There is a guy living just a block away, Perry Young. Does that name? He is about my age, a little younger. He was a student here, dropped out to become a journalist, and became really one of the first actively, openly gay journalists. He wrote a book with a member of the NFL, Dave Cope, the first gay member of the who came out with professional athlete. And he's written also about, he has a book about the Falwellites called God's Bullies. But even he didn't go far to explain, you know, what's the nexus between these right-wing homosexuals and their politics. Mm-hmm. The Congressional Club has had people like this in their employ from time to time. And it's just a mystery to me. And that statement I just thought was ludicrous in the paper this morning. I mean, I'm sure somebody is going to be provoked. Maybe this Perry Young, who now lives in the Women's Center on Henderson Street, to respond and say, you've known lots of gay people. I mean, I don't admit it, but...
So, as a practical matter around the state, you were outed by Jesse Nelms?
Yes, I think, or actually, of course, Windsor did a much better job.
We're on the local level, Windsor.
Yes, that's true. But I don't think it was a very good outing. I think it was third class. It just wasn't... you didn't say enough. And, of course, by then, I mean, although, like, there never was the one kind of, not so dramatic, but clear incident that I'd wanted. It's just that I became identified with all these gay rights resolutions and became a very close friend of Lightning's, and there was no doubt that he was gay. So I think that without ever making a public statement, it just became accepted. Or realized and accepted locally, there still would be people, you know, who I remember coming home, again, from a Democratic Party meeting, somebody gave me a ride home, and he said to me, this is somebody who had voted for gay rights resolutions for about 10 years at this point, he said, Joe, your house is pretty big for one person. Are you married? I mean, you know, just didn't get it, but there are always people like that, but most people have figured it out.
So what was the experience of going to as a Mondale delegate like?
Well, again, it was, as I said already, I began to be quite good friends with Tom Charlton in Washington, and he realized there weren't very many people in North Carolina who were likely to make it. And so he persuaded me to come out for Mondale very early. And frankly, that was not an election in which very many people locally came out for Mondale ever. He just was regarded as too dull a candidate. And maybe they were right. But I called the people in Raleigh very early and told them I would do everything they wanted, which wasn't very much, for Mondale. You know, I had a stand at the street fair and blew up Mondale balloons and talked up Mondale. And then I had very little trouble persuading the local party that I would be a good Mondale delegate, and I had done a lot of work for a long time, and that was not hard to do, and we put together a coalition with other people in this congressional district, and even though I thought it would be not too difficult, it was actually very easy to get elected, and I think even, you know, people who go to Democratic Party meetings, whatever their particular views or ideology, they tend to be pretty sophisticated. That is, they're hardly typical people who are registered Democrats or even typical people who think they're Democrats. And they're much more cosmopolitan, even if they're from, and I mean this, even if they're from Apex or Asheboro, and in our congressional district in that year, they were from those places, then you'd guess. And I think they even took a little pride in having an openly gay delegate. It was, you know, made them look more progressive, more with it, more... Mm-hmm. They weren't traditional or Hicks or mm-hmm. conservative. And I really had a relatively easy time. And I had a great time in San Francisco. There were, by that time, about 25 openly gay delegates and a bunch of alternates and people who hangers-on. And there were all these receptions that the San Francisco gay and lesbian community put on for us, and they celebrated us. And for somebody who was viewed as from Jesse Helms' backyard, well, that's not the way I view myself. It's the way that, you know, I got a lot of attention. Of course, politicians love attention. And within the Democratic Party, the North Carolina delegation, I mean, I detected some minimal coldness from some people, but, you know, the head of our delegation was, the real head, not the nominal head, was David Price, who was an Orange-County Democrat, you know, who'd known me for a long time. And I knew Rufus Edmiston, for example, from his wife's work in historic preservation. He'd been helpful to us as a state figure on that issue, and there are a bunch of people who had been UNC students fairly recently. So it was a fairly congenial, and then there were, even though I was a minor delegate, I voted with the Jesse Jackson people on the token resolutions that were thrown our way, and that made, and I knew the head of the Jackson delegation from North Carolina, though she was from Durham, worked in Chapel Hill, a Livonia Allison, a sort of quirky figure in the Durham committee. So it was really, I wish the convention had gone on for longer. It was great, great fun. And, you know, those things are, if you ever known anybody who's gone to it, there are exceptions, mind you. But
I actually was at that one myself, though, unofficially.
It was pretty crowded in there.
Figure out a way to get on in there.
They actually make you believe that your candidate is going to win. I mean, I think I had no doubt when I left San Francisco that Walter Mondale would be our next president. And, you know, I was wrong. But
One thing I'm trying to be sure to ask people is their sense of what the leaders of the state Democratic Party in these years are, how they're trying to respond to perhaps accommodate black and gay concerns in the Democratic coalition as they try to carry the party forward. It's not an easy trick for them to pull off.
No, it isn't. I think for the more theoretical stuff, you'll have to ask my fellow former Tougaloo professor, Paul Lubke, but because I think he has thought about that, and I haven't really talked with him recently about that. It seems to me on the practical, ad hoc sort of level that they respond to pressure. I remember, it doesn't really matter what year it was, it probably was 84, because I don't really like state conventions, even when I go to them. But they had watered down the gay rights resolution, so it was barely recognizable as a gay rights resolution. And, you know, we didn't quite know what to do, whether to dump the whole thing because it was so meaningless, or to press a little harder for what we wanted. And it's very hard for a handful of gay delegates, and that's from Orange County, you know, the most left county in the state, to work a state convention. There's just too many people, and we don't know enough of them. So what we did, instead of working the whole convention, is we worked the platform and resolutions committee. We had two good friends on that committee. One was a former next-door neighbor of mine, a paraplegic woman, who was on there because she was disabled. And she was a very strong supporter of gay rights. And the other was, both these people are dead, they were both wonderful Democrats and people, was Richard Whitted. Her name was Lockhart Fallon. She was, until she died, was head of the governor's, the agency changed its name, but head of the governor's task force for people with disabilities or something like that. And Richard was, of course, the model county commissioner, was the chair of the Orange County Commissioners, was the head of the statewide organization of county commissioners, was a very wise and able and progressive public figure. He also died long before his time, as did Lockhart. But they were both on the committee. And during some break, Lightning and I, and probably Gloria, I don't know who else, just went up with them and said, you know, can't you do something about this? This is so weak, we'd rather you just threw it away. And they said, well, why not? And they made it stronger, and it passed. You know, and they didn't say anything about, this is how it works on a personal level so often. People just don't say things like, well, we know that you like this, and we agree with you on it, but it's going to hurt the party. I mean, people may think that, even they may think that, certainly other people think it, but they often don't say it. And Al Adams, who I'm pretty sure was the chair of the Credentials Committee at that convention, and who was a very pragmatic liberal, if he was opposed to it, he could have blocked it, but he didn't. So that's my view. I mean, the number... I have heard some second or third-hand evidence, but no first-hand evidence at all that these people believe what, you know, Lyndon Johnson said, that after the Voting Rights Act, I don't know who he said it to or where or when, but somebody said it was, you know, it was the right thing to do, but it will be the death of the Democratic Party, that kind of... and people may think that, and that when they're in their small groups, people who think the same way they do, they may say things like that, but... and of course, I mean, we gay people are just a very small subset of the larger group, which is mainly black, and maybe women, but not even women are nothing compared to blacks.
Yeah. Well, your now being an openly gay candidate at issue in the 85 town council race?
No. I can count the number of anti-gay or possibly anti-gay things on one hand, and they actually were both in 87 when I was even more open about it. Twice when I was going door to door, once was a student who had a Helms bumper sticker on his car, and I thought, oh, why bother with him? Then I said, why not? He also had a bumper sticker of a conservative candidate for town council, Mickey Yule. And I knocked on his door and said, I'm Joe Herzenberg. And he said, I know who you are, and I'm not supporting you. And I started to say, thank you. And I said, why not? He said, well, I don't agree with your positions. And I said, which position? And he was actually quite knowledgeable, and he began rattling off things he disagreed with me on. He shouldn't have voted. And he finally said, and your position on homosexuality. I said, well, thank you very much. And then once an older man, I was walking up to him, he was working in his car in his driveway, and he said, he not only didn't want to talk to me, but he didn't want me ever come back to his house again. But those are the two negative stories from that campaign, and frankly, I can't. There may have been others, but they're so insignificant. In fact, in '87, when we had a really great campaign, I had a real campaign manager, Mike Nelson, who had really good ideas about how he had he had a friend, a close friend, who had run for Congress, he'd followed this woman's campaign. He thought he knew how to do it, and he sure did. I wasn't even going to run that year. I'd already lost three times. It seemed to me I was becoming the Harold Stassen of Chapel Hill politics. But he persuaded me to run, and with his management of the campaign, I won fairly handily. And what was great was that about a month from the election, there was a gay march in Washington. And lots of people from here went, and I think it was an incredible, energizing experience for lots of local people. I had lots of gay people working in the campaign, knocking on doors, a bunch of more closeted, older gay men did a fundraiser, and there was no doubt that it was a gay campaign. And at one point, Mike and I talked about how we would deal with any anti-gay reaction to the campaign, and we basically thought that anti-gay attacks would be good. That is, yes, that's right. Good, not good in the overall sense, but good in the narrow sense of the campaign.
Mm-hmm. What were the issues that you saw before Chapel Hill in '87 in terms of your platform? What did you think you had to do when you?
Well, I think I had something like 40 of my brochure. I think I had something like 30 or 40. Specific positions. It was really outrageous. And I remember when I ran for re-election in 91, counting how many we had managed to work on. It was a pretty high proportion. And some of them were very specific, like dealing with a tree ordinance or doing something about noise as a neighborhood problem. But frankly, most people were just interested in the overall growth. I think I took a moderate position on that growth, that for controlled growth.